KHUM is freeform independent radio from Humboldt County, California. Learn more at khum.com.
Everybody get on your hands and feet and put your hands together for Ray Raphael. They're not going to do that at Bloomberg.
No.
I'm glad for you. It is good to see you, and I have read, I think I've read all your books at this point. Maybe I haven't read all your books, but I've read like the last four of them. The latest one is called Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. Let's start with a little bit of background on you. You are a Garberviller. Villain?
A Garberville?
Are you?
Am
you
I a
live?
Villain?
Where do you live?
Well, people call us villains down there. Yeah.
Yes, you're a Garberville.
Redway.
Redway.
Yeah,
Redway.
Yeah.
And we always sort of think of you as one of these people who happens to live in Humboldt County because your work goes around the world. You will be talking to. Are you going to do Goodman? Are you going to talk to Amy Goodman?
No plans. Nope.
I'll see what I can do.
There you go. Put it in. All right.
I don't have her number.
Yeah, but I am doing a lot of radio shows around the country. Funny little places like Troy, Alabama, and Wheeling, West Virginia, and then Wisconsin Public Radio, which is a good one.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then the KPFA syndicate there, and I did Kansas this morning for the first one, and KHUM is number two.
Yes, that is how we like to be thought of as
number two.
Yes,
you always try harder.
When you think of KHUM, we're number two. What you kind of have built a little franchise out of is looking at American history and the way that we think of certain sort of now mythologized, in many ways, angles on it. You know, Molly Pitcher, for instance, like the legend of Paul Revere. Like, what really happened with Paul Revere? And you pull the documents and you sit in fusty libraries and inhale weird old book smell. And go through the stuff, and you try to pick apart what is true and what is not. Is that basically what you're doing these days?
Yeah, although these days things are a little different because there's so much stuff that's been digitized. I can actually do a lot more of my work without getting sick in the lungs from those musty books.
Don't you
and worse yet, the microfilm.
Stuff.
Yeah. So it's actually when you first started with the archival work, a lot of musty books, you know. Microfilm is poor quality and has its own kind of like chemical sort of, and then microfiche, and I don't know. But now there's a lot of the stuff that's been digitized. And in particular for the Constitutional Myths book, the materials on the Constitution have been a lot of them digitized. So that makes it easier. And for instance, on the ratification of the Constitution, this isn't yet digitized, but there's 22 volumes of the documentary history of the ratification of the Constitution, and they have in the public HSU library. So that gives you access to other people who have done the archival work, and then you have to go through those 22 volumes and actually but it's all primary sources. Because the way I work is secondary sources always tweak things. And as a matter of fact, they tweak them more and more these days, particularly when you're talking about the Constitution, because everybody's got their own way they want to tweak it. So if you start reading something about any kind of contentious issue now from a secondary source, you're going to see somebody who has mined the vast amounts of primary material, volumes and volumes. If you're looking for a quote from the founders, the famous founders, you know, you take the six most famous founders, the first four presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, and then you add Hamilton and Franklin. And together, there are 216 volumes of their works so far. And they've gotten less than halfway through Adams, and Washington is still incomplete. And so you can go through that stuff, and pretty much it's like the monkeys typing on the typewriter with Shakespeare. And you can gather, you know, support for just pretty much any position that you want to get from that vast amount of material by taking a few sentences here and there out of context, not only out of context within, you know, whatever paragraph or something that there is, but out of political and historical context. You don't know what the people are referring to back then, and it might have nothing to do with what we are referring to now. And that's the kind of mythology that's happening here that I talk about in Constitutional Myths. When I wrote Founding Myths, it's a little different. The Founding Myths, people basically invented these stories in the mid-19th century about the American Revolution to lionize the revolutionary heroes, and in the process they kind of hid the true story. Constitutional myth is a little more complicated because it's not just in the 19th century. It's everybody's doing it, and they're still doing it today. And as a matter of fact, they're doing it more than ever today. So those are the kinds of things I'm trying to address, is people's misconceptions that claim to be based on the historical Constitution. And I'm going back to the original documents in the original context of the Constitution to try to sort out the real deal.
Well, I want to ask you about 10 million things, including originalism and the current day justices, and of course stuff that is happening on the TV right over here, where the Constitution is being kicked around with regards to equality. I think a lot of people would know this, but I think in Humboldt County and on the internet at large, it's very easy to only see your own side of things. Like, you subscribe to only, say, liberal people on Facebook, or you subscribe to only conservative people. And so the echo chamber gets louder and louder with each passing year as the technology changes and we are able to prune what information we get. And so
let me just add that the echo chamber is also coming at you. If you Google, if you are a gun rights person and you Google liberty, you're going to get a bunch of gun rights liberty things. And if you are somebody who is for some other, you know, maybe not into that, and you Google liberty, you're going to get some name of corporation, Liberty Fund or something.
Right.
And so people are, I mean, there's the echo chamber is actually coming back at you through the process of using the internet.
Like, you know? I want to get an unbiased view on this, but Google itself is using your own search history to trim your search results.
Exactly.
So yes. Anyway, the point is this. Everybody is cherry-picking the Constitution these days to make their own viewpoint more valid or more historically truthful. Everybody is doing it. Liberals, conservatives, everybody's like, this is my Constitution. Do you think that's good, that everybody identifies with this one very enigmatic document?
No, I think it's terrible. I think it's good they identify with the document. I think it's terrible and a gross insult to the people who wrote the document and an insult to the people who lived through those times. I think it's kind of cannibalism, actually, where you're taking these dead people who can't talk and can't fight back, and you're tweaking their words, which might have very little to do with what your thoughts are, and you're trying to eat their words and have them nourish you. And I think it's a terrible misjustice. And that's why I wrote Constitutional Myths, is because I say what I want to do, I want to do the Constitution justice, and I want to do the people who wrote it justice, and I want to do the people who considered it and ratified it justice, and the people who opposed the ratification, them justice, by looking at the real historical moment. And to look at the moment, we have to read history forwards, because what we're always doing now is reading history backwards, going back from our world and trying to, you know, get back to theirs. So I try to disregard that and say that this is a momentous historical occasion. We are still reaping the rewards because they did create a document which has survived, and the very existence of that document has helped keep the nation together. So there's a lot of respect due to that, but to pay that respect, you have to treat it properly. It's like you don't eat the bones of your grandmother. You know, you try to find out who she really was. You know, who was my grandmother? You don't say, oh, my grandmother would have loved Facebook. I mean, that's a stupid question. It's a stupid way to look at things.
Your grandma could have been very racist.
So was she racist or not? Well, maybe she was racist. Okay, so then you start to find out, why was she racist? What was going on at that time, you know? And then you have a deeper look at who your grandma was. Maybe she was a great person but a racist because of the culture around her. And the same thing with the Constitution is like, what was going on then? And when they talked about, say, government, or when they talked about taxes, or when they talked about rights, or when they talked about any of these things we talk about today, what was their language? What were they thinking about? And then I'm not talking about originalism, like we have to do it exactly the way they did, because they didn't have enough information to govern us today. They are very poor guides to tell us how to deal with body searches on the airport. They don't have the reference points. They don't know about 9/11. They don't know this. They don't know nothing about that stuff. They don't know about airplanes. They don't. So you can't look at it to that level. They are very good guides to understand some basic principles about the place of government in our lives.
We're talking with Ray Raphael, whose new book is out now. You can see a link to it and his website over at khum.com, and there's a buy thing there. You're also going to be at Northtown Books at 7 p.m.
On Friday. This Friday, the 27th, yeah.
The book itself is...
The 29th. Today's the 27th.
I don't know.
It's one of those days.
Like, what is time even really, man? So
you got me going there. Hey, come on, this is history. Time is important. Today is the 27th, and we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Okay, we got a tsunami drill happening today, right? Okay, we don't even know about the monster tsunami that's happening tomorrow.
Right.
Or not.
Yeah.
You see, in
You're
our world,
me out, right?
I know, our world is based on what we know right at this moment, and the future is unknown. And that is what history is about. So you got to keep that one date, the 27th and the 29th. Okay, I'm really going to get you.
Here and now.
Okay. What are American attitudes towards Muslim people on September 10th, 2001? And now we're doing a study of American attitudes towards Muslims on September 10th, 2001. And now compare that with 2 days later on September 12th, 2001.
Oof.
And tell me that you won't, the
things
dates don't
changed.
Matter and
yeah.
that things don't matter, a matter of 2 days, you see? So, boy, that was a heck of a lecture, huh?
You just got very angry at me.
Oh,
Ray
yeah,
Raphael.
Keep your dates straight, says the historian.
Let's push this thing forward. In your book, which is intensely researched, you have 53 pages of notes. You have about 50 pages of actual documentation. But before I get to the main question, a side note. What's up with spelling? How come we spell fully F-U-L-L-Y? In a lot of these documents, you'll see it F-U-L-L-I-E. Is that just old English remnants, or is that, you know, barnyard literacy? I don't know what's happening in there.
Language, like life, just evolves. I mean, that's what it does. The American language, there's kind of a political context. Does he know a Webster? You know, the Webster Dictionary? Well, he was a Federalist, and he actually he wanted to unite the nation. And he said, if we're going to unite the nation, we have to basically give formal recognition to our own American adaptation of the English language. So there was a political component to the development of that language. If we said something one way, and you know, so we actually changed a lot of the spellings of color and color. Do you have the U in there or not? You see, a lot of that was self-conscious. A lot of everything people do is actually has some kind of intent. And the evolution of language is somewhat just kind of evolutionary and somewhat intentional.
I can see that, yeah. And subversive almost.
Yeah.
Okay, so you go through all this research. You read all these documents. You publish some of them in the back of your book. You sit through microfilm and microfiche and old-timey books and new-timey laptops to get your background. And you open your book wherein President Washington set out from New York on a road trip. And he just like – he's like, all right, country's – you know, the dust is kind of cleared. Let's go see this thing. Like, what's going on? And so he and six servants and two aides, they get in with probably a buggy, right,
mm-hmm.
something like that. And they go across the land, stony but strong, covered with grass and a luxuriant corn, a crop of Indian corn. We met four droves of beef cattle. We scarcely passed a farmhouse that did not have a lot of geese. And you're this super agrarian, like people just kind of huddled together along the eastern seaboard. And that passage, he was going through the Bronx.
Yeah, the Bronx, home to whatever, 1.something million people with all the high rises and all the vacant buildings. And I mean, it's, you know, such an entirely different world then than now. And I open there because I really think to get into the Constitution, you have to start with that headspace. You have to start with the knowledge that their world was that much different. And that's the only way you're going to be able to access things. Now, this is something that you guys at K-Hum are going to understand very well because...
Because it's in short monosyllabic words?
No, because it's something you guys care a lot about. You care a lot in K-Hum about domestic violence. And you do a lot of great work about domestic violence, right? And you are referring to spousal abuse and such, okay? Domestic violence is mentioned in the Constitution. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Tell what?
Absolutely. Wow. And now if you are, you know, like a political person for spousal abuse, and then you're going to say, hey, look, the Constitution says about domestic violence. Yes, the government is empowered to suppress domestic violence, insurrections. Domestic violence, it was a word for insurrections from within the country.
Okay.
And that's an indicate. You see, that's the, you know, so when you study, you have to abandon your headspace and get into their headspace. Domestic violence meant people rebelling against the government.
You mentioned that, and in your book you talk a lot about the Bill of Rights, and let's discuss that for a second. There is a passage here where you talk about sort of a proto-Bill of Rights. This was in the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, which listed 98 specific rights that people were entitled to enjoy. Among them, if you are getting beaten by your husband, you can leave. That's mm-hmm. fine. Also, if you are if a master smites out an eye or a tooth, you can leave. This is one of your 98 rights. Also, in this bizarre document, witches and homosexuals could be put to death. That's not a right necessarily. So let's talk about like the origin of the Bill of Rights and why it's not really and its relationship to the Constitution.
Yeah, well, the document you referred to is from over 100 years. It was very early on in the Massachusetts settlement, well over about 150 years before the Constitution. And I have it in there to show that the language of rights was deep in the culture. And that's a great example because as you can see the evolution of rights right there. They are paying attention to some things that are very dear to them because there's a lot of not spousal abuse but apprentice abuse. And if you are indentured to a master, they smite you and so on. And so, you know, they're paying attention to that. But as you say, they're not too keen on civil liberties there in Puritan Massachusetts. And they, you know, they draw the line at witches and such. So, but it's in the bringing that forward to the Constitution. It's a delicate balance because the people who are when they're framing the Constitution. What they are confronting then is what they feel is a breakdown of civil society after the Revolutionary War, which, you know, that the war kind of bonded people together against a common enemy. Once that is over, some of the differences within the American culture and economy start to surface. There's a great deal of debt, public debt, and so the state governments are taxing people, through their teeth. And there's the British merchants are clamping down on payment. They need it in currency. So suddenly the farmers are getting crunched by the merchants that they grab, go to the store to, by their tax bill. And most we know about the insurrection in Massachusetts. It's called Shays' Rebellion after one of its leaders. Actually, Shays, which is only one of many leaders, it's kind of a bogus name. But all across, that was only the tip of the iceberg. Society was kind of crumbling in terms of splitting apart between debtors and creditors, and basically a kind of class warfare all across the states. And so that's what triggered the people coming together for the Constitution. And they wanted to cobble a strong government, not a weak government. They didn't want to drown government in a bathtub because the government was already drowned in a bathtub, and that wasn't working out. The 6 months before the Constitutional Convention, the federal government, Congress, collected a grand total of $663 from the states to run the nation, which at that point was clear from the Atlantic to the Mississippi and from Canada down to the Gulf Coast. So they know that they have to get a stronger and vigorous government. They know that, and that's their commitment on the one hand. On the other hand, the people are going to somewhat resist if it's too strong. And people are imbued with a culture of rights, and so how are you going to weigh those two things? And that's the historical moment that I'm talking about in constitutional myths. How they weigh those the need for a strong government with the need for liberties.
If people want to take a couple of questions?
Yeah. If anybody's there, sure.
It's sort of a daunting subject matter, and you are a daunting dude. In a good way. But if people want to call in, let me give you the number. This is a different number than the actual studio number. I'm going to give you the hotline phone number, which is 786-5488. 786-5488. 88. Call that if you want to ask a question about the Constitution while Ray Raphael is with us for the lunch hour. Speaking of taxes, this is a thing that Glenn Beck's, you know, and people of his stripe love to harp on with regards to the Constitution and taxes. Could you tell us what you found in your research?
Yeah. They like to think that the founders were anti-tax, and to support their position, they look at all of the evidence. You know, they go into the 216 volumes of what the founders said, and they find out little gems. For instance, here's one that you see actually quoted on anti-tax websites. This is a quote from George Washington in his farewell address. And it says, I've got to take my glasses off here. It says, no taxes can be devised which are not more or less inconvenient and unpleasant. Now, that makes sense. That gives you the idea that Washington is saying no taxes can be devised that aren't inconvenient and unpleasant. It sounds pretty anti-tax to
sure.
me. Yeah, yeah. Here is the passage, the full passage, okay? It is essential that you should practically bear in mind that toward the payment of debts, because the country was in debt, and because he also explained earlier that you needed to have good credit in order to stave off any kind of aggression against your country. If somebody invaded you, you had to be able to raise money quickly to fight back. So you need credit. But it is essential that you should bear in mind that towards the payment of debts, there must be revenue, that to have revenue, there must be taxes, that no taxes can be devised which are not more or less inconvenient and unpleasant. But we need a spirit of acquiescence in the measures for obtaining revenue, but which the public exigencies may at any time dictate. It is essential. It is necessary that public opinion should cooperate. So you have
it's like the opposite,
and but you can extract these things, and that's what they do. And the truth is that to taxes we owe our Constitution. I mean, that's a hard truth, but it's something that when we struggle, as I am right now, to get my taxes in on time and all that stuff, that the whole point was to give Congress the ability to tax, because without the ability to tax, it was trying to create a viable nation on $663 for 6 months. Now, okay, we can double that for the annual budget, whatever that comes to be, $1,300, whatever it is, okay? Still, I think, insufficient, and they certainly felt it was insufficient for a growing nation over a third of a continent.
I think we may have a caller, and we'll go there in a sec, but just a ballpark figure, like $667 is rent now, but in that day, how much money, ballpark? Are we talking like $100,000, something like that?
No.
That less?
Much. Oh, yeah. Yeah, less than $100,000. But, yeah, yeah, okay. So, yeah, multiply it yeah. something. But, you
nothing.
Know. Yeah, but.
Chump change.
It's obviously. Not. The point, I mean, they didn't have an army. Part of the problem when there was an insurrection in Massachusetts, and the Massachusetts people said, we can't, our militia won't put this out because half of the militiamen are in the insurrection. So we need the federal army to come in. But there was only like a handful of posts on the western frontier dealing with Native Americans out there. And Congress had no money at all. So the insurrection was put down by a private army. The rich people hired an army to put it down. And that's the level of what happens when you don't have a government, when you actually get private armies fighting you know an insurrection. So you know nobody thought that was a good that wasn't a sustainable. That's our term, but I think they would go with the basic concept. That's not a sustainable way to run a nation. They needed something. They needed the words they used. We need to create a government. That's not just a federation of the states, because the earlier one, the Articles of Confederation, Congress had no power to raise money. It couldn't pass laws. It had no coercive power over the states if they asked for money, and the states there's no enforcement of that. The states could just refuse, and that was it. And they say we need better than that. We need to create a real government that's strong, and the words they liked was vigorous. and energetic. And now that's not the language we hear today. We hear government is bad, government's the problem. The concept of government, you can argue that maybe the government has become, you know, a different kind of thing, but the concept of government and the concept of the public good, it's not just personal liberty. The public good is paramount, and you need to keep that in the forefront. And you can't just say it's all about liberty and nothing about the public good, or you're really violating the basic intent of the Constitution.
Ray Raphael is our guest. His book is Constitutional Myths. We're running out of time. It's 10 till. But we got to talk about originalism, because that part of your book. Let's see if this caller – you've been waiting for a very long time. Did you have a question for Ray Raphael? Caller, go ahead. No? Okay, that was the moment that they said, no, I'm not in it. So there are ways to look at the Constitution as a living document or as a static document. The framers obviously put the amendment process in place because things change and stuff gets real and our views of the world change. Could you real quickly outline the two large schools of thought here, and then we'll go to some tape, and I want to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Well, I'll outline them first. People can think about it, and then we can talk about it later. The two main schools of thought is originalism, and there's forms of that, the different forms. One is we have to look at the original intent of the founders, what they intended to do, or we look at the original language at the time, what it meant at the time, and what the people who ratified it thought they were ratifying it. You treat it as a contract, and how did they understand that contract? And then the other school says, wait a second, no, it's a living constitution that evolves, because you can't just get stuck with the values at that time. And if you do, all kinds of funny things happen. And after your tape, I can tell you a few funny things that are going to happen.
Before we go to it, true or false, Thomas Jefferson said you should rip up the Constitution every generation.
Not quite true, but he did have an evolutionary feeling about this. Of course, he personally had less at stake than the others because he wasn't there, so he kind of like spoke more from his – he was off in Europe. And also he had a lot less stake in it once he became president, and he didn't feel quite that way, and he turned into quite the tyrant in enforcing the Embargo Act, and that's a whole other story.
Well, there's a new book out, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically called, I think, Ignore the Constitution. Do you know this book?
It's called The Unwritten Constitution, maybe, and there's a movement that says, wait a second, it's not just the basically ignore the Constitution. We need to start a new one because it's all outdated. And, well, there's kind of two forms. One says it's not really what the Constitution says. It's the whole culture that's evolved since then. That's an extreme form of the living Constitution theory. And the other says the whole thing is so hopelessly outdated, we need to start again.
And that is the perfect jumping off point for this. There's a radio show called the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Do you know about this?
No.
Well, you don't need to. It's quite boring. But it is popular, and there are two guys, one of whom impersonates Thomas Jefferson and answers listener questions. They did a show on the Constitution, and they got all kinds of email, and then this blurb popped out, which I wanted to get your thoughts on.
We're pretty well devoted to the Constitution that we have. I think it's crippling us as a nation. I don't think that the Constitution was divinely inspired. I don't believe that God has a special providence for the United States. I don't think the Founding Fathers were under a certain influence of the divine. I think these were extremely well-educated men who loved liberty and were in the right place at the right time, and conditions brought them together and concentrated their extraordinary minds into producing this extraordinary document. And it is an extraordinary constitution, and it was certainly an extraordinary one for the period in which it was written. But we don't live in that period anymore, David. We live in a very different period of the history of the world, and it is far from clear that that constitution is serving us well at the present time. Now, I know what some people will say. Well, if we would just go back to what it actually said and stop inventing new things or having judicial activism or traveling away from the clear intent of the Founding Fathers, we'd be fine. Wrong. We'd be infinitely worse if we had a literalist reading of the Constitution.
Do you agree with that?
Definitely, I agree with the last statement, because all sorts of things would be embedded into law. For instance, you could say, well, slavery is it would be over because it was amended. But, for instance, women could not own property. A married woman could not own property, and there's no amendment that has dealt with that. But their concept of the Constitution was based on a concept of property, which was based on what they call couverture. The woman is covered by her husband. And so no woman today who is married would own her property. And the Equal Rights Amendment didn't deal with that, because it didn't deal with women, wasn't mentioned, women weren't mentioned, and the Women's Suffrage Amendment didn't deal with that. So we'd still be living in that. That's just one example. And you can come up with many more, that their world was so different than ours that that we can't base it on that. They're kind of like their moral sensibilities at the time are not ours, and we have to allow for that. But why don't go as far as the speaker does to say we should ditch the whole thing and start anew? Because, you know, if you imagine the partisanship today, just on every tiny little thing, they'll filibuster a judgeship. And imagine if they're trying to change the rules, the fundamental rules, we would get absolutely no. It would totally tear the
press done that we're getting.
So
done
now. what you need is you need an in between thing. You need something, and I you do have to culturally. Our culture is based on this thing called the Constitution, and we have to accept that, and we can use that concept. What we can't do is take this literal meaning the original intent of for every little thing, and think that that's the way we should stick forever, because history doesn't work that way. The framers certainly didn't think that way. Every one of them said this is an imperfect document. Not one framer said we got the answer. They all said, no, this is a start. We need something to get on the way. You can amend it. You can evolve. At the very end of the convention, Ben Franklin was said, well, what did you get? He was asked, what kind of government did you get? He says, a republic if you can keep it. Now, Pat Buchanan uses that, and the right uses that to say, if you can keep it, they think that they put the emphasis on keep. They think if you can keep it, keep the same thing just the way it was back then. Well, you know, yeah, okay, well, let's also keep the Bronx the way it was. If the Bronx stays that way, and if guns are all muskets, and you can go on and on about if the life is exactly the same, and we'll keep it that way, and that's one way to do it. But history doesn't do that. But I look at Ben Franklin's a republic if you can keep it. I don't say if you can keep it. I say republic if you can keep it. In other words, the onus is on us. We have to get with, and they were clear about this. They don't. Madison, of all people, you know, for whom is kind of bogusly called the father of the Constitution, even though he lost out on way more issues than he won. But he says you can't look to the original intent of the founders because. That doesn't mean anything. The original intent, if you look at the original intent of any particular piece in the Constitution, because it was a political document forged by compromise, the original intent of virtually every passage was to garner enough votes to pass that passage, and people would have voted for it for a million different reasons. So you can't look for that, but you still have to keep the basic structure of a Constitution, and you have to admit that these things, it has to evolve with historical evolution. We're looking at that right now. We're not comparing this kind of equality with the founding time, but with the 14th Amendment and equality. Because the Constitution didn't do anything with equality. That's the 14th Amendment, okay? But today, right now, the Supreme Court is saying, does equality improve account with gender preference? You know, does that have anything to do with it? That's an evolution, and we are looking right before our eyes and watching minute by minute society evolve on that. And it's a fascinating kind of.
It's kind of fun to watch.
It is fun because it's history in the making. Yeah. It's very historic. It's not as sudden as the fall of the Berlin Wall. you know, which was very amazing when that happened for those of us who really watched it happen. But it is something when you think of 5 years ago where this was and where it is now and how rapidly it's moving, and then seeing this institution of the Supreme Court trying to deal with that. And think back to the 1850s and them trying to deal with slavery in the Dred Scott decision. And you're seeing some of that same residual resistance to a clear evolution of societal norms.
Ray Raphael is our guest. It's KHUM, Garberville, Eureka, Arcata, translator K282AD, Eureka. He is at Northtown Books on Friday at 7 p.m. This is why people should get your book, is because if you drive around with somebody who happens to have conservative talk radio on, like, this is the thing you need to know. Like, these are the debunkers and the historical context that would make that car ride a venue for a vigorous airing of differences, to say the least. But barring that, I just got a couple more questions. Modern day or even historical deviance from the Constitution, like, we now know that the Emancipation Proclamation was pretty unconstitutional. It was kind of backhanded the way it went through, and we know that it was supposed to be a temporary thing as a wartime. We now mm-hmm. know that was not the deal. I want to ask about cloture in the Senate, where, you know, supermajority. And the founders were fairly clear that cloture and supermajorities are something that you only invoke in, like, hard times, like with treaties in wartime.
They were very clear. They went back and forth about these sorts of things. You know, what requires a supermajority was a very clear do you need a supermajority for the passage of navigation acts? That was a big issue, and finally they decided no. Do you need it for the ratification of treaties? They say yes. Yeah. How about overcoming a presidential veto? Supermajority? Yes, I think we do. And then they went back and forth. They started with 2/3 supermajority. Then they went to 3/4. And then they went back to 2/3. So this is something that they had very much on their mind. When do they need a supermajority? And they settled on those few instances. The clear implication is those are the only instances. The other checks, people say, well, we need it as a check. They have a zillion other checks, ways to check power, of the Senate checking the House checking the Senate, and so on. And those were the ones that were structurally built in. This idea of a supermajority needed in the Senate has nothing to do with the founders. It was a rule of procedure within the Senate, and it was done at the time when the Senate was sort of more of a gentlemanly thing, and they figured, well, they kind of wanted to go more on sort of a spirit of consensus, and they figured, well, if you can't get more than 60, you're really not doing that. But it was practiced very rarely, and primarily by Southern senators who were outvoted on civil rights issues. That was the main purpose of it. And nowhere, certainly the founders would have said, "Hey, this we didn't put that in."
No, you guys use cloture all the time now.
Yeah.
It seems almost inarguably that supermajorities themselves, accepting the scenarios that you described just a minute ago, are totally unconstitutional, and yet nobody cares.
Well, the reason it's not that they're unconstitutional, because there's nothing that bars them, because it's not given as a constitution. It's just the Senate. They said the Senate makes its own rules.
Yeah.
It's procedural. The Senate does make its own rules. But here's why they would have hated it, and because their whole point was to create a strong and effective government. Effective, that was the thing. It had to be efficient. And insofar as this has made government absolutely inefficient and unable to come through with the tasks that government must do, it is absolutely counterproductive to their overriding aim. And this is why I'm saying that there is some essence in that. You want, in going back to the history, and you're not looking point by point because these things change, but you can look at these overriding aims. You can look at the fact that, yes, they did want a strong and efficient federal government. They did want a balance between state and local powers, and they outlined what those would be. They did want some flexibility, enough so that if something is necessary and proper to some of the goals, that every single thing doesn't have to be listed. If you want to have a a lighthouse. It doesn't have to be listed in the Constitution. The government does have that kind of that sort of implied necessary and proper to regulate commerce is to have a good functioning lighthouse. So these are the overriding principles that we can look at. But if you get too stuck in the times, it's not good. But if you get too abandoning the times, like you just like forget about their overarching goal of efficient government, you get to that point there where we have now. People are essentially trying to shut down the government. And boy, that is not that's not unconstitutional, but it sure is a violation of the basic spirit of what these guys were about, which was to create a strong and viable government with dual sovereignty, federal and state, where federal does override state when they conflict. I mean, that's their basic principle, and I think it's a good principle, sound principle. If we understand it historically and stay with that, we're going to be a lot better than if we, like, take every little quote out of context and say this proves that this proves that my theory about this little thing is correct, because that's the way to just, like, run roughshod over them, and it has nothing to do with them and everything to do with us.
I'd like to end by asking the man who just wrote an intense book about what the Founding Fathers were going through in their own time. Should we just stop trying to figure out what the framers intended? Is that healthy for society anymore?
I don't think it's healthy for it's not healthy to say what they intended in that very, when you do a line by line reading. I do think it's healthy to understand the historical context of the Constitution and seeing what problems they were confronting and how they created a flexible document that has been able to survive. That is helpful, and I don't think we can throw that away or should throw that away. And that's what I'm trying to do in Constitutional Myths. I'm trying to put it back in history. If you treat history respectfully, you learn from it and you can take from it. And if you treat it, irresponsibly, you're basically violating everything good that they have done. And as I said earlier, you're cannibalizing history, and you're trying to make those people work for you in service of you. And that's not the way it should be. We are in service of ourselves for each other. We should be talking with each other. We should be we should shout less about all this stuff. And we should all say, okay, this is the way we have a constitution. And it served us well, and that can be some of the language of our discussion, but we can't get all haywire. And I wave one phantom constitution in the air, and you wave another, and then our constitutions do a duel. That gets us nowhere, and the whole originalism thing is sort of like that's where that leads. And I want to wave one other thing. It's totally arbitrary. When people say originalism, like Scalia is originalism,
He's
and
big,
Thomas originalism,
yeah.
These guys, and they're totally arbitrary on it. What is the originalist perspective on Citizens United? Did the founders really think that corporations are people?
Strict interpretationism of the Bible. It's the Bible says it's okay to stone a baby to death. Are you going to interpret that literally?
There's no originalist argument that can even approach corporations or people. They're fictive, absolutely fictive, and they don't have the rights of people and blah, blah, blah. And that is a later construction from the Gilded Age, and we're haunted by it today. Would they have liked the fact that there is unlimited influence by special interests over government? That's exactly what they were trying to get around. And if you look line by line about what they're doing, they're trying to limit the control that any group has over government. It's the most, if you take an originalist position on Citizens United, you don't even have a case. I mean, you throw it out before. And yet the originalists totally ignore originalism when it counts the most, because they only bring it out when they think they can tweak it their way, which shows that it's not originalism. It's just another way of waving phantom constitutions in the air. And it maybe sounds a little more sophisticated, but it's no better.
Ray Raphael, the book is out now. You can get some more information at khum.com. You can pick it up at Northtown. Where is it? Where is it available locally? Is it Eureka Books?
Oh, yeah.
They should have
it? Yeah, Eureka, Northtown, certainly.
Great. Mm-hmm. And, of course, khum.com. You will be presenting the book at Northtown Books in Arcata, 7 p.m. this Friday night. You got a class to teach, so you got to run.
Yeah, and if you come there, bring your questions and we'll talk more. We got a couple hours there. Okay.
Thank you so much. That's Ray Raphael. We'll be right back.
This has been a KHUM production. For more information, check out khum.com or search KHUM in iTunes.